Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein. This is Perek Ted Zayin, Chapter 16 of Melachim Bet of the Second Book of Kings. And here, in this chapter, we're going to meet a king of Yehuda, of the Southern Kingdom, and we're going to see an evil in him that will be less explainable than the earlier evils that we've seen in Malchi Yehuda. Other Malchi Yehuda we've seen who were evil had more obvious reasons for why they had connections to. So for the Midrash Tanchuma in Parshat Vayetze says, these are the Rishaim, these are the evildoers of the kings of Yisrael, of Yehuda. There's Yehoram, so we know that he had family connections to the northern kingdom, to the Achav family, so that sort of explains it. And there was Yoash, who we had said that perhaps his having lived in the Beit HaMikdash for a while gave him or led him to believe his advisor when they said, clearly you're above the law by virtue of having lived there. And then there's going to be Menashe, the grandson of Achaz, who will be evil as well. We'll have to talk about him when we get to him. But here, we're going to find that Achaz will also qualify as a Rasha, and his evil will stem from something that seems relatively innocuous at first. So in Pasuk Aleph, Bishnat Shiva Esrei Shana Lefekach Ben Remaliyahu, in the 17th year of Pekach ben Remaliyahu, Malach Achaz ben Yotam, Melech Yehuda, Achaz takes over the kingship. Ben Esrim Shana Achaz ben Molcho, he was 20 when he took over the throne. V'shesh Esrei Shana Malach b'Yerushalayim, and he rules for 16 years in Yerushalayim. V'lo asah yashar b'nei Hashem elokav k'David aviv, and he did not do what was right in Hashem's eyes as David his forefather. Vayelech pasuk gimel, vayelech b'derech malchei Yisrael, and he follows the lead or the path of the mannerisms or the ways of acting of malchei Yisrael, of the kings of the northern kingdom. V'gamed b'noha evir ba'esh, and he also passed his son through the fire, k'tu avot agoyim, asher hovish Hashem otam mipnei b'nei Yisrael, like the abominations of all the nations that God had removed from before the Jewish people. So his choice, in his decision to follow the ways of Malchei Yisrael and to follow the ways of all the nations that God has driven from before the Jewish people, is a strange one that we'll have to think about. In the next parak, there is a suggestion among some of the commentators that he saw the success of these nations and therefore decided to follow their ways. But as we'll see now, in these coming psukim, it's not so clear that that makes sense. So let's read the psukim, and then we'll see what we mean by that. In pasuk dalal vayizaber vayikater bavamot ve'al hagivot v'tachak kol yitzra anan, and he offered sacrifice and incense on bamot, which we've seen for a lot of times, and givot in high places and mountains and hills, v'tachak kol yitzra anan, and under every green tree. So tachak kol yitzra anan is a phrase already we find in the Torah as locating places for Avodah Zarah. In other words, he's finding all of the options for where you worship Avodah Zarah, and he is making use of them. Pasuk Hey, Az Ya'ale Ritzin Melech Aram, Ufekach Ben Remaliyahu Melech Yisrael, Yerushalayim LeMilchama. So now he's got a problem because the king of Aram and the king of the northern kingdom come to wage war against him. Vayetzuru Al Achaz, V'lo Yechlu Lihilachem. And they make siege on Achaz, but they're not able to actually conquer him. So then, at this time, Ritzin is not able to conquer Jerusalem, but he's returning Eilat to Aram. It's apparently a city. We all know it as Eilat. And he getting rid of the Jews from Eilat. And then Edomites came to Eilat. And they take over it. And they live there until this day. So Achaz is in a militarily weak position. Pasuk Zayin, Vayishlach Achaz Malachim al Tiglat Pileser Melech Ashur Leimor. He sends messengers to Tiglat Pileser, who Chazal, as we said, identify as Sancheriv, Leimor Avdecha Vinchani, saying, I am your servant and your son. Alei Vahoshieni, come up and save me. Mikaf Melech Aram, Mikaf Melech Yisrael, Akomi Malai, please save me from the king of Aram and the king of Israel. Worth noting that in this case, and we had seen it in the previous parak as well, the previous chapter as well, Sancheriv's first introduction to the region that we see here is the Jews turning to him or calling on him or asking him for help. So here, Achaz invites him into the region in order to give him assistance. And he not only invites him, he pays him. He sends it as a bribe
to the king of Ashur. He takes all the silver, Kesef, and the Zahav and the gold that's found in the Beit HaMikdash, as well as in his own storehouses, and he sends it as a bribe. Pasuk Tet, Vayishma Elav Melech Ashur. So the king of Ashur pays attention, listens, and accepts the bribe. Vayal Melech Ashur El Damesek Vayitpesel. So he goes to Damascus and he captures it. Vayigleha Kira, and he exiles the members of that city to another city called Kir. Vetritzin Hemit, and he kills Ritzin, the king of Aram. So this effectively ends at least that threat to Achaz. So in Pasuk Yud, Achaz now goes to greet him and thank him. Vayelech HaMelech Achaz Likrat Tiglat Pil Eser Melech Ashur Du Mesek Vayaren HaMizbech Asher B'Damasek. And he sees the altar that's in Damascus. Vayishlach HaMelech Achaz El Uriah HaKohen Et Demut HaMizbech V'Tavnito L'Chol Ma'asehu. So he sees the altar and he has plans drawn up, the form of the altar and the shape of the altar, and he sends it back to Uriah HaKohen, who's back in Yerushalayim, and he's going to tell him that he wants him to imitate this altar that he's seen. So why is he doing this? So if the suggestion is that he had seen their success, the success of these kings, and therefore he decided to imitate it, so that's a problem here, because it's the altar of Aram that he seems to be imitating, and the altar of Aram is not the altar of a successful king. The altar of Aram is the altar of a king who has just lost to Sennacherib, meaning if he adopted the gods of Sennacherib, as we're going to see Sennacherib suggest the southern kingdom of Jews should do, it's going to happen later in Chizkiyahu's time, so in a few years after Achaz has passed away and Chizkiyahu has taken over the kingship, it's going to happen then. Had that been true, then we would have understood it. But here Achaz is doing it, and it doesn't seem to be that way. So it's a little bit of a mystery, but we'll talk about it as we go on. The other piece to notice is Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayivan Uriah HaKohen Ar Mizbeach. So he sends the plans to Uriah HaKohen. Now, one reaction we could have imagined having is Uriah to say, for all that you're the king, right? The southern kingdom, we've said, is not generally a place for rebellion, not generally a place for killing the king or revolting against the king. It's not clear that Uriah has to say, okay, and build it. But Uriah does go along with it. So that willingness to go along with what the king wants, I think, is a very significant weakness worth paying attention to in many societies today, societies back then, but certainly in the case of Uriah Kohen, meaning that had Achaz not been able to find people to join him, that would have been a problem, and he would not have been able to overcome that. So, but here he does. He builds Mizbech, Kol Hashesh Shalach HaMelech Achaz Midamasek, Kein Asa Uriah Kohen, Advo HaMelech Achaz Midamasek. So he builds it and he finishes and he completes it by the time Achaz gets back from Damascus. So he comes back from Damascus, he sees the altar, he makes offerings on the altar, and he goes up and he offers also burnt offerings on it. Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayakteret Olato v'Minchato, his burnt offerings, his flower offerings, his libations, Vayaseich Et Nisko, and he sprinkles the blood of the shlamim sacrifices onto the mizbeach as well. So what happens to the authentic mizbeach? So he pushes it aside, right? He moves it whereas before it was between his mizbeach and the Beis HaMikdash and the Heichal, he moves it to the northern edge of his. And what does he do in Pasuk Tevav? Vayitzaveh HaMelech Achaz et Uriah HaKohen Lemor. He commands the Kohen to say, Al Mizbeach HaGadol, meaning his, that he's just brought, Hakter et Olat HaBoker b'Minchat HaErev, et Olat HaMelech b'Minchato. So the Korban Tamid in the morning and in the afternoon, and the Ola of the king, and the Mincha of the king, Vayit Olat Kol Am HaAretz b'Minchatam Etzkeim, and the Olot of all of the people, and their flower offerings and their wine libations, v'choldam olav v'choldam zevach alav tizrok, and all of the bloods of the burnt offerings and of other offerings, you should sprinkle on that. Meaning that's going to become now the central mizbech of the Beit HaMikdash. Mizbech hanechoshet yeli levaker. And occasionally, I will go and I will visit and I will use the other one, this other Mizbeach that has always been the real Mizbeach. So basically he has decided that the altar and the shape of the... See, it's not that. We've seen before
the possibility that kings could come along and decide that the Mizbech that we're currently using needs to be adjusted in size. So there we think that Shlomo HaMelech had a bigger Mizbech than did the Mishkan, that you might have made a bigger Mizbech, and the Yecheskel speaks about a Mizbech. So the exact dimension of the Mizbech don't have to be the same. The proportions might have to be the same. There are minimums, there are this, whatever, but the Mizbech could be bigger. But it's not that. It's that he took a Mizbech and he took the shape of it and the form of it from a non-Jewish source. And then he uses it to largely replace the Mizbech there. And Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayas Uriah HaKohen Kol Asher Tzivah HaMelech Achaz, Kechol Asher Tzivah HaMelech Achaz. Uriah HaKohen does exactly as Achaz commands him to do. And then Achaz's disinterest or willingness to change or lack of regard for the Beit HaMikdash as it was appears in Pasuk Yud Zayin as well. Vayikatzeitz HaMelech Achaz El HaMiskerot HaMechonot Vayasem Yalem Et HaKiyor Vetayam Horid Me'al HaBakar HaNechoshet Asher Tachteha Vayitinoto Omret Sefet Avanim. So just to get the English out of the way, my English says, and Achaz cuts off the borders of the bases, and he removes the kior, which is where the Kohanim washed their hands from, off of them. He took down the sea. When Shlomo Melech had made the Beit HaMikdash, he made this yam for decoration. He took it off of the bronze or the copper oxen that they were resting on it. And he puts it back. He puts it down on the floor. Now, the Radak understands all of this to mean that he puts all of the things on the floor, the various of the vessels on the floor, and he says, he did it to denigrate the Mikdash, to denigrate the Beis HaMikdash and all of these kelim, all of these vessels, and so he puts out some of the lights maybe, and he closes Daltot Hashem so that people can't get in, and he does, as it says also in Divrei Hayamim, and he says, and he puts other altars in throughout Yerushalayim, and he puts in stones where there wouldn't have been stones before. There would have been these mechonot, these fancy items and decorative items, and he instead puts in stones to make it look less nice. Pasuk Yudchet continues, "Ve'et Musach Hashabbat Asher Banu V'Bayin Ve'et Mevo HaMelech HaChitzona." He saved Beit Hashem ibnei Melech Ashur, and the Musach Hashabbat. So the Radak says it was like a covered building when they wanted to go under it. Meaning, what happens is there's a rotation in the Beis Hamikdash of Kohanim. It wasn't true that Kohanim spent their lives serving the Beis Hamikdash. He had a 24-week rotation, meaning there were 24 groups of Kohanim who would take turns serving in the Beit Hamikdash, and so it was only your group's turn every 24 weeks. That's one thing that people often don't realize about the way the Beit HaMikdash worked. And then, aside from that, another aspect of how it worked is that it started and ended on Shabbat. So Musach HaShabbat, the Radak understands, was a covered area where the Kohanim, whose job now was to leave, they didn't want to just leave on Shabbat, and they had limits to how far they could go, so they would gather there and wait out the rest of Shabbat and sit there. So this Musach HaShabbat, which they had built there in the Beit HaMikdash, and the Mavoha Melech HaChitzona, and the special entrance for the king, he saved Beit Hashem mipnei Melech Ashur. So he turned it away from Beit Hashem, and he hid it, and he made it not be a place that you could see where it was going because of the king of Ashur. So what's going on with Achaz? He breaks the pattern of Malchei Yehuda, so we can't say that he's just a follower, somebody who just decided to one day give up on his he did decide to give up on his heritage. Somebody who was born in a certain cultural environment, and that's what changed him, that's what ruined him, that's what was a problem for him. You can't say those things about Achaz, because he grows up in what we would think of as relatively a strongly influencing environment, a properly influencing environment. So, what is it that goes on? And we don't have many clues here in our prakim. A couple of clues, though, are first his seeing an altar in Damascus and deciding he needs to copy it. So, what's that need to copy their altar? What's going on that he feels like, oh, they have an altar, I've gotta, I've got to get that for my house, right? I've got to get that for my Beis HaMikdash. And then aside from that question, important as it is, aside from that question, I think a further question is, then what, or how does this relate, or what is it about that once he has this altar, he has to put in the Beit HaMikdash and have it become the central or the chief altar, and have the existing altar, the existing Mizbeach, decline in importance. Meaning, I could have imagined that he would say, I really like this new altar, let's take it and worship with it and do things with it. And that would have been more than enough of a tragedy for the Jewish people, since we're not allowed to do such things, and it's against the laws that Hashem has commanded us. And eventually, when you violate the laws that Hashem commands you, you eventually pay the price for it. So, and we'll see in the next chapter that the northern kingdom, the Malkei Yisrael, are going to pay that price, and their reign is going to come to an end. Their commonwealth is going to come to an end in exile, which is never a very good outcome for what we're looking for. So, I could imagine that he would just have an interest in it. But what was the urge to tell Uriah that, you know, I want this to be built by the time I come back, and I want it to be in the Beit HaMikdash, and I want it to replace what's going on there? So replacing what's going on there sounds, at least I hope should sound, now we sort of see a new dimension to just how much and to what extent he was replicating what Malchei Yisrael were prone to do. Malchei Yisrael, their chief crime, their chief problem was that they tried to stop the people from coming to Yerushalayim to worship at the Beit HaMikdash. And now we see Achaz not trying to stop the people from worshiping the Beit HaMikdash, not to that extent, but we do see him worried about or bothered by how influential the Beit HaMikdash is. So, the Radak says that among the things that he did to downplay the importance of Beit HaMikdash was to set up altars all over Yerushalayim, aside from all the things that we've seen they did in the Beit HaMikdash. So I wonder whether Achaz, and again, we can't know. So it may be that it's just that he thought all the other nations were more successful than he was. But it's an odd claim, because they don't seem to be more successful than he was, or not significantly more successful than he was. So we're not given much of an understanding of what would lead him to be so concerned and so adamant about this situation. So I wonder whether it's either, like we said, with Malchei Yisrael, we know why they would object to the Beit HaMikdash, and why they would try to resist its influence among the Jewish people. They would resist it, and they would resist and resent it because it was a direct threat to their rule and to their power over the Jewish people. Or at least they understood it that way. They were worried that it was a direct threat to their rule. So we see that. But why would Achaz worry about it? Why would Achaz be bothered by it? So I wonder if it's not just a question of being bothered by the centrality or the requirement of one place of worship. Right? The one flaw that we've seen repeatedly stressed by the Psukim in terms of Malchut Yehuda, in terms of the southern kingdom, the flaw that has been is that they continue to insist on being Mekater Babamot, on being Mizabeh Babamot, on sacrificing on the Babamot. The Babamot, after all, are places where one offers sacrifices to God other than the Beit HaMikdash. And part of the point of the Beit HaMikdash, and according to the Rambam, the central point of the Beit HaMikdash, was to teach the Jewish people, A, that sacrifices were not the only way to worship God, and then to make sure to limit those sacrifices only to the one place that God had certified as acceptable to offer sacrifices at. So if that's true, then what we see in Achaz is an objection to that very idea, a resistance to that very idea. So then when he goes to Aram, he goes to Damascus, this is a great altar, this is a really exciting altar, this is a very beautiful thing. So of course I want to be part of this. And so he sends a message to Uriah, listen, we're going to keep up with the times. They got this great idea. Oh, it didn't work because Aram has lost. So we as Jews know that that's not a good answer to idol worship. If you believe in an idol, if you believe in a certain form of a worship, you worship it regardless of the power of it, because, you know, we wouldn't ever say, for example, in Lahavdil Elif Afdi Havdalot, certainly very different, but we would not say that if there came a time when we don't see God helping us, that would say to us, oh, time to abandon God. So I'm not sure that that would be a convincing argument for Achaz either. But I think what we see is that he is concerned with making the point that it's not one worship. It's not you worship God in this way and that's all there is to it. That's, to many people, would be the kind of a thing that you'd say is narrow-minded and is a view of the world that limits God, and how could it be? And there's so many beautiful ways of worship out there, and domestic, they have this beautiful mizbeach, and of course we want to take that. So I wonder whether Achaz is really not rebelling, not against, of course against God, but that his central evil is that he has taken what was always a flaw of the Jewish people, of the southern kingdom, of Malchut Yehuda, that they were mizbeach, and he's taken it to an extra degree, that he's made a principle out of it. Not only because I think that it's okay to sacrifice anywhere to God, but because I think all worship is beautiful. You know, you could put this in very modern terms. There are many people today who will say, you know, what the Hindus do, it's beautiful, and it really taps into some spiritual source. And what the Buddhists do is beautiful. And what the Christians do, and the Catholics do, and the Muslims do, and the Jews do. So, they all contradict in terms of what they say about the world in ways that are incompatible with each other. So the people say, yeah, so don't worry about that. It's a question of the beauty of it and if it really works together. That might be what Achaz was motivating Achaz. At least that's a way that I have to understand what was motivating Achaz, because again, otherwise I don't understand what would lead him to act as he did. It's not that I don't mean that I want him to be justifiable. I mean that it's not even intelligible. And I find that a little uncomfortable. But put this way, I find it not only intelligible, I find it familiar. I think there are many people who will be drawn to beauty and will say, if it's beautiful, it must be true and it must be valid and it must be valuable. And I think, I think that's not true. But I think it's very common. And then, if we put it in those terms, we understand what it is that Achaz was doing. I have a way of understanding what it is that Achaz was doing. Achaz is expressing his dedication to multiplicity, expressing his dedication to beauty, and to all those kinds of things. And then if there is a version of religion that objects to that, well, so that's a threat already, because that's not, right? It would be similar to people today who would say, you know, if somebody threatens some cherished Western ideal, whatever it may be, if they threaten this ideal, then they're a threat to us. So the truth is, and this is true, when it comes to the question of pluralism in religiosity, at least the pluralism of the kind that they're talking about their time, when the question is, can you worship many idols or one God? So Judaism was antithetical to. It wasn't just that Judaism didn't agree with or didn't accept or didn't sign on to. Judaism was strongly opposed to the view that said that you could worship many things and you could see the beauty in all of them and accept the beauty in all of them and live with the beauty in all of them. So Judaism did not accept that as a possibility. So if that's true, that it's possible that that's what Achaz was bothered by, was fighting against, was resisting, and would be why he would choose to do all these things to the Beit HaMikdash and to demonstrate that there were wrong ideas at the heart, at the center of the way the Beit HaMikdash worked. So I don't think that we have the full answer necessarily. Evil is not always fully understandable. That's part of what makes it strange and different and evil, is that it surprises us with its straying from what we think of as the right and the good and the proper way of acting. So, but I think it's a possible suggestion that at least puts Achaz into some kind of an intelligible framework and lets us know that it's not just that he was out to ruin everything, but it suggests to us why it would be that he would pick on the Beit HaMikdash to do it. And it says that the challenge he was facing, or the challenge he was trying to put to the Beit HaMikdash, was exactly the one that is difficult for the northern kingdom, and that is difficult at a smaller level for the southern kingdom, and he takes it to that extra degree and says, it's not about the Beit HaMikdash, it's about worshipping whichever ways you want, pretty much, however you want, wherever you want, and doing the things that you think of, or that somebody tells you are, the ways to worship God. And if that's what people say, then that's what it could be. And the fact that you have a long-standing tradition that says, no, no, you come from a people who only worship God by sacrifice in one place in the world. We can worship God anywhere in the world, right? We can serve God anywhere in the world. That we certainly say. But the idea that we can only worship God in the sacrificial rite, with sacrificial rites, one place in the world, so that was an ideal and an idea to which Achaz, at least, apparently objected. And that is the root, I think, of his evil. So it will leave his son, Chizkiyahu, with a tremendous burden of needing to overcome that evil and undo that evil. And we will see Chizkiyahu's attempts to do that in coming Parakim. Of course, Parak Yud Zayin is going to be a long, difficult, but full chapter, giving us the reasons for why the northern kingdom finally gets sent into exile, and those will capture many, many of the themes that we have seen before and put them all together into one very rich parak. For the meanwhile, though, we have to leave our day knowing Achaz and seeing his evil, an evil that seems to sort of come out of his own. It's just his own idea, his own thoughts. He's not born into an evil family. He doesn't have a history of evil. And then he just goes off and becomes it. So we will see that tomorrow. For now, have a great day.